This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Ned Balbo is here with us. We are virtual. Pretty soon we'll be back in those marble halls, but today we are in the ether, and we're going to hear from Ned Balbo with an opening poem.
The Silburn Touch-Me-Nots. You showed me at the Silburn Arboretum how the small receptive plant drew back politely, as I wouldn't, as I'd never seen a plant draw back from someone's finger. You lowered your hand. More plants shrank from its motion, rippling in the raised bed, leaves withdrawn, like seawater parted by the wind, dislodged, a flying insect rose and hovered. The touch that stirred their soft waves to recoil lasted an instant, nor did we stay long, but took some other trail among the trees and gardens' ill-kept grounds. If we return to check on them, who knows? Perhaps we'll watch shy leaves reverse and make their stand, unhurt by touch or threat, green fronds unfolding till the surface of their sea is calm again.
It is very good to start with that poem because it says so much about you, Ned. It says that on the surface, all is silky, but underneath, a lot is going on. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Yes. And that is the title of your book. What is the title of the book?
Well, The Silburn Touch-Me-Nots, and that is an arboretum in Baltimore. But I think I like the idea of the touch-me-not plant that draws back at your touch, because there's much, I think, in poetry that's intimate and invites intimacy and connection, but at the same time, much that we keep at a distance, that we keep detached as we observe and look at the world.
I love the way you go from one line to the other, and it just keeps rippling down without the leaves withdrawn. You just move like liquid gold. The way your juxtaposition from stanza to stanza, we're going to hear more about that. And I want to tell people some of the things about you, and they will not believe these awards. You should leave some for somebody else, Ned. This is Ned Balbo's new book we're talking about, The Silburn Touch-Me-Nots. That was a new criterion. Then Three Knights of the Perseids won the Richard Wilbur Award. Both of those were in 2019. Then Upcycling Palmanock, Lives of the Sleepers won the Ernest Sandine Prize. Galilea's Banquet won the Towson University Prize. And The Trials of Edgar Poe and Other Poems won the Poets Prize and the Donald Justice Prize. I give up. Really, Ned, don't you think you are a little bit greedy here? I mean, an award a year? Come on.
I don't know if you feel the same way, but whenever I finish a manuscript, and sometimes the poems are plucked from many different periods of my writing, some from far back and some more recent, but creating poems and publishing them are two different things. So I'm really lucky some of the poems are being read.
And maybe we win. Folks like yourself. Are you a formalist, Ned?
I don't consider myself a formalist in terms of some sort of poetical, political standpoint. I wrote in free verse in my youth like everyone else, but as a lover of music and a reader of poems early in my life, of course, I encountered lots and lots of poems that were in meter and rhyme, and loved them and loved practicing that format and loved the challenge that it offers.
Well, that leads us to another poem where I'm going to shine a light on your form. So let's go on, Ned. This is Ned Balbo. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Greeting the Monarchs. Escaping October frost, the monarch butterflies return. Borders mean nothing to the souls of the dead when they return. The Greeks believed that butterflies were human souls set free. What flies from our grasp is unlikely to return. A river of orange flame pours into the hills above a village. The dead rest in a place of spirits till they return. The urban grid below devours red clay and bulldozed land. Some monarchs remember their former lives when they return. The chrysalis in which they form is sturdy and mysterious. Monarchs are fewer every year that they return. The dead will find their way to altars that bear their photographs, Candles arranged in the shape of a cross guide their return. Some say a god appeared and changed the dying into monarchs. Elders and children, shivering with cold, do not return. Monarchs cluster, hibernating, hundreds clasped on a single branch, whose souls reside inside of them when they return. The sky, filling with monarchs, is like a kaleidoscope of fire. Some fly to the summit or the sea and never return. In March, they depart when able, bond, and breed on the journey north. How will we greet them if they leave but never return?
Tell us about using return every second line. What form is that?
Greeting the monarchs is a ghazal, which is based on Middle Eastern models, which were originally written in Persian, Arabic, and other languages. And they can be of any length, but they have to be composed of couplets. And the second line in each couplet includes part of a line that serves as a refrain. Poetic forms are not just a challenge, but they're also fun. And part of the fun of this particular form is that the poet is supposed to sign his or her name in the final couplet. And in this case, the signature comes in the form of an anagram, Abel Bond, which is an anagram of my name.
Ned, what does this do for you, this form?
What it does is it allowed me to look at a whole idea of myth, possibility, resurrection, life after death, and the way they combine and fuse, I think, with present-day contemporary history. You know, we think of borders and we think of folks struggling at the border, certainly turned away or in some cases imprisoned, as has happened in recent years. We think also of the way that the human spirit, souls and spirit themselves don't respect borders. What are the boundaries between life and death, the boundaries between the body and the spirit and the soul? And of course, the land, too. When you look at the land that's been bulldozed and damaged from above, as you know, flying monarchs might see, monarch butterflies, or any of us in an aerial view, it's damage to the body of the land and to the earth. So I wanted to find a form that would allow me to bring all of these things together into a single presentation.
Yes. Well, you're an ecologist as well as a poet, and we're going to look more into your form if you'll read us another poem that illustrates that. This is Ned Balbo. We're at the Library of Congress in Uno Senso.
This type of poem is called a pantoum, and you'll notice lines repeating, refrains coming up again and again. And part of the trick is that the first and third line of one stanza become the second and fourth lines of the next stanza, and so on through the poem, forming a kind of chain. This one's called A Parable of Flight, and I had some fun by making it rhyme too, which isn't strictly required by the form. Parable of Flight. Wouldn't it be great if lizards flew? The world's mind thought and thinking made it true. The pterosaur, ascendant in the sky, would last an age and over eons die. The world's mind thought and thinking made it true. From trilobite to slow triceratops, some good ideas would over eons die. The bird-hipped dinosaur took baby steps past trilobite, beyond triceratops, till Archaeopteryx, the feathered lizard, sought the sky. No time for baby steps. Sharp claws and teeth protected it from hazard, though the creature looked less bird than lizard. Was its blood, perhaps, already warm? Sharp claws and teeth protected it from hazard when it fought, inflicting real harm. The blood of carrion is always warm. Who flew beside the starling and the crow? The passenger pigeon, though it meant no harm, rose up in great flocks, shadowing the snow. But who survived? The starling and the crow. And yet, the world's mind also loves a joke. Ostrich and emu, striding over snow, lush veldt or outback, took another look, because the world's mind always loves a joke, and said, no thanks. The concept in reverse. The dodo, too, from which a single look, sad-eyed, brought traitors' clubs down with a curse, followed survival's trend line in reverse. Would it have fared much better in the sky? It couldn't tell a blessing from a curse. Earthbound, unfortunate, it never flew.
That's Ned Balbo with a pantoon. What did you have to overcome to write that?
I think that the main thing I had to overcome was having written bad pantoons in the past. Although that wasn't the first good one I wrote. I certainly had apprenticed myself to the form previously and had ranged from bad to mediocre till I finally started writing a few good ones.
That will encourage everyone who's trying their hand, because I did a sestina one summer. It took all summer for three sestinas, and it looks like three marble pillars. I know better now. So let's keep going on with you and find out all the variations of your voice. Let's shift and go into a people poem.
Okay. The next poem is called Whose Son, Whose Daughter, and it's a villanelle, a type of poem that features repeating lines, with the challenge being to find ways to make those repeating lines, those refrains, come back in ways that sound natural in an organic part of the poem rather than something forced in. For most of the poem, the two refrain lines are separated by a line in the middle, but they finally come together at the end as the last two lines of the poem. When I write both pantoums and villanelles, I tend to vary the refrain lines so that they're not exactly the same. So maybe that's a form of cheating, or maybe it's a form of adding a pleasant and useful variation that's, you know, I guess in the ear of the beholder. When I was 13, I found out I was adopted, and that a girl I knew who lived around the block, who I thought was related in a very distant way, was actually my sister, and she was being raised by our grandmother and her husband. And I should mention, I didn't know they were related to me either. My sister and I went through third grade on through middle school and high school together, but didn't know we were brother and sister until very late, and had to live with that and go to school together knowing that. Whose Son, Whose Daughter, from my sister Evelyn, circa 1975. Sister, when you blew smoke against the glass, I looked up at the school bus, stood below in snow. For months, you knew whose son I was, whose daughter you were. A block away, your house, grandparents who'd raised you, waited. Crunching snow, the bus moved on. You blew smoke on the glass. Red stoplights flashed, brakes groaned again. Your voice carried as you stepped off. Don't look back now. For months before I knew whose son I was, we'd pass in the halls, then look away. I guess when told, you thought, it's better not to know. I watched. Laughing, you'd blown smoke on the glass. While I imagined other lives for us, those missing years. If I'd been raised with you, all gone. I thought I'd known whose son I was, but now, too late, you'd passed from view. The bus scattered exhaust on snow heaped by the plow. How much was lost, like breath against cold glass? You tried hard to forget whose son I was.
Ned. That is so powerful, so beautiful, so contained. I believe one good use of form is to contain the tumult beneath, that you have to be orderly because of the power of the feelings beneath the line. That is really powerful.
Yes, totally. The use of form allows you to look at the world and to look at yourself and any of the turmoil inside with more detachment, and of course, time's important for that too.
And since you do go back to the past, take us back some more, Ned. Take us back some more.
Looking back musically, I think the death of Prince was a terrible loss.
Oh, agree.
Absolutely. Wonderful songwriter, performer, you know, every genre you could imagine. Multi-instrumentalist, played so beautifully, so amazingly. But one of the things that not everyone knows about him is he was also a very generous and anonymous donor to the music programs in Chanhassen, Minnesota, or where he grew up. And so anonymously made sure that music programs had the kind of funding and instruments and resources that they needed in order to continue to thrive and introduce young people to the joys of music. Musicology for Prince Rogers Nelson. What boy or girl standing at the keyboard after class hears music no one's playing, caught in memory? The risers wait, ready for chorus members to line up. Sandblocks and sleigh bells lie at rest until tomorrow's class, and yet this black piano, electric, digital, pulses with power, still plugged in, screen aglow. What girl or boy untrained, used to all the old cacophonies that classmates bang out when the teacher leaves, resists the urge or heeds some other call. Who hears something and has to let it out? The period's over. Everybody's gone. Ethereal xylophones, their voices muted, lie beside their mallets in a box. Stacked tambourines, untouched, produce no sound. And so, because you gave so much to many through your songs, sweat-soaked performances, dance moves a blur, medleys falsetto-drenched through funky breaks and shouted ribaldries and more, an artist moved to charity who shared his largesse with those most in need. Anonymously, you made sure this boy or girl or any classmate here could pause within the haven of his solitude, keep listening, draw near the instrument, and gently bring one finger to the keys to capture what might soon have disappeared unheard. The fragment of some favorite song, the scattered notes that rescued form a tune brand new. The chorus, soon to start rehearsal, tromping down the halls, will bring their noise, chaos, and teasing with them, though for now, this girl or boy persists in listening, alone but changed, the overtones just summoned, with the last note ringing still, alive in mind and ear, the world enlarged somehow as all that you've awakened slowly stirs.
Ned Balbo on The Poet and the Poem. Well, you may not have been born in Minnesota, but I suspect there was a Ned in a classroom at some point in a music room after the period had ended. Is that true?
Yes, I certainly use my memories of chorus and music class in elementary school and middle school and high school to enrich the details in that poem.
Yes, and that's why I want to touch on your own music, which is beautiful. If you can give us a verbal link so that people can see you singing with those beautiful graphics, how might they be able to see that?
Well, they could visit YouTube and search the song title Crow in the Courtyard along with my name. Or if they just would like to hear some songs, they can hear audio only by visiting Bandcamp and use the search term Ned's Demos.
Yes, and they are visually beautiful too. So you can actually maybe go under your name and just plus YouTube. And do you think that you write about people as much as you do ideas and situations? Do you think you, I don't know all of your work, but I don't know how many portraits you do.
Yes, I think I do. I write a lot about people, a lot about animals, a lot about the world, and a lot about ideas. And I don't always think about any of those being separate from each other. I think of them as being fused, deeply connected, at least metaphorically and maybe in reality.
Mm. I like very much the poem about your stepfather. Would you read that to us?
Before I learned about my birth parents and my sister's existence, the only father I'd ever known was Carmine. And he had a certain habit, which he also thought was important to teach me. And it's one I think that probably a lot of folks have, a family member who lives according to the same philosophy. The sugar thief, for my adoptive father, Carmine. If it was free, you taught, I ought to grab it, as you did. McDonald's napkins, pens. And from the school where you were once employed as one of two night shift custodians, the metal imitation wood wastebasket still under my desk. But it was sugar that you took most often as, annoyed on leaving Dunkin' Donuts, Pancake House, and countless diners, I felt implicated in your pleasure, crime, and poverty. I have them still, your Ziploc bags of plunder. Yet I find today, among the loose change in my pockets, packets crushed or faded, more proof of your lasting legacy.
Very tender. Very tender poem. And have you written more about this man, Carmine?
Most of the times that I return to family poems, there's usually a sequence in which he plays some role. In some ways, each time I create a sequence of family poems, I'm thinking of those sequences as part of a much longer sequence. There's one in my first book, Galileo's Banquet. There's one in my third book, The Trials of Edgar Poe and Other Poems. And there's one in this new book, The Silver and Touch Me Nots, where the complications of my adoptive background and the implications for issues of identity, for issues of how we create families, for issues of what constitutes kinship, all of these are things I'm looking at.
I see that. And because I value very much your order and your form and your crispness, which conceals huge waves of emotion, read us a couplet poem.
Yes, this is in Split Couplets, Ouija for Beginners. And of course, the Ouija board had its origin here in Baltimore.
No.
Yes, it did. And when I say the Ouija board had its origin, not the Ouija board itself as a concept, which was part of that whole 19th century fascination with the occult and with contacting those on the other side, but the Ouija board as a game that could be manufactured and sold. A fellow named William Fuld saw the opportunity and created that board that we all know so well and standardized it and started selling it. So the epigraph for Ouija for Beginners, Ouija knows all the answers, weird and mysterious, surpasses in its unique results mind-reading, clairvoyance, and second sight. The Ouija board requires two believers seeking favors of the spirits. As above, so below. The planchet window inches toward a numeral or letter. With a shudder, characters accrue to words or names. Random sums to dates. Lost birthdays, anniversaries, at which we freeze in recognition. Cold hands quivering, our wavering connection to the dead, a revelation. Will a vision welcome us tonight into the dark? What else might lurk beyond the world we let ourselves behold? Forget the old apocrypha of how the term was coined, the two words joined to form a double yes in French and German. Learn to listen for assent. Refusal in the silence. Sift the nonsense mixed with truths half spelled out on the board, where all you've heard or dreaded lies encoded. Patience now. The dead are slow. They've all eternity before they nudge the planchette edge through hands you thought were yours, quite powerless to rest on yes, or just as easily, no. Unless it's you who move it too.
That is terrific. And I spent many happy, delusional hours when I was young on one. That really is. And as I say to my students, make it look pretty on the page. And I think you counted syllables, because if anyone looks at that on the page, it is perfect. Oh my gosh, extension, compression. And the couplet is really nice to contain spirit, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is.
So I would love to have a closing poem.
Oh, a closing poem. Unearthly Crow. Who are you, Crow? Fire thief? The gods familiar? Trickster in endless orbit, touched by night? How long will you keep flying round the world you either made or witnessed being born? Eons, perhaps, or many years at least. One black eye holds the continents below, the Earth's curve toward horizons. One eye holds galactic distances as dark as time, uncharted worlds past measure. The only proof of planets so far off they can't be seen is gravity's effect. Are you like that, invisible and dark, riding the currents through mythologies? Does every comet you surpass bring ill luck, or do you? Whatever trick you have in mind must wait till you break off from flight, relieved at last the Earth's torn paper shorelines, azure seas, your charge no longer. Nor should we lay claim to your attention, finally, when you do. But won't you tell us what your vision holds? One eye, the stars that mark this endless circuit and eternal watch. The other, stars that cities scatter nightly to the waiting dark.
Are there more Crow poems?
Crow hour. It's the hour of dark and not dark, hour of wings gathering in the trees on brutalist ledges, hour of shades alighting to claim a place, the hour of trading places, hour of secrets roosting at rest, hour of blackest vision, shoulder to shoulder, drawn to this haven's height, calls to this refuge, heralds of mob and murder, wrongfully named. An hour of multitudes, vigilant, restless, watchful for hawk and owl, Hour to be wary, aware. No voices, no cars, the sky pale violet, to view with a scavenger's calm. Intruders below, whose faces they notice and know, but heed not at all at the coming of strays and stragglers. Hour of cause and cause, beyond our ken, hour of kin, who soar over power lines, turning to black leaves, filling each long bare branch, and more are arriving. Hour of crows awaiting a sign that the hour is over to fill the sky.
The crow in the courtyard is watching the shadows from high on the wall.
That is the voice of Ned Balbo, and this is The Poet and the Poem, produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and additional support from the Sinipet Fund, Maryland Humanities, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.